Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing. I am Jeremy Goldkorn, hosting alone today as Kaiser was called to more tropical climes for business this week. Today I'm privileged to be joined by James McGregor, a journalist turned businessman and author, and one of the characters who has truly livened up the scene in Beijing in the last two decades. Jim's been the Wall Street Journal's China bureau chief, the chief executive of Dow Jones China business operations during much of the 1990s. He has been the chairman and a decade-long governor of the American Chamber of Commerce in China, and advised and invested in a number of the most interesting business deals of the last decade. He's the author of 1 Billion Customers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Doing Business in China, published in 2007. And now, just out, No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, The Challenges of Chinese Authoritarian Capitalism. And we're going to discuss that book today. Jim, welcome, and thank you very much for coming onto the show.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
Let's get straight into it. No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers. One reviewer on Amazon.com described it as a broadside against the current state of China's business and economy. What inspired you to write this book at this moment in time, and what is the main argument of the book?
Well, let me talk about the title first. It comes from a Tang Dynasty poem, Qianbujian Guren, Houbujian Laizhe, which means going into uncharted territory, doing something nobody has done before in a very risky time. And that is kind of where China is right now, and I didn't come up with that. It came from a quote that one of China's top economic planners, a guy named Liu He at the Development Research Center State Council, that's how he described where China is. So I pulled it off a quote from him in an analysis he had written. And that's kind of what's going on. I guess it's a broadside in that nobody tells the truth about China these days. Business community is scared of China because they may get retribution. The political community is confused. And no one is kind of laying out the facts. And, you know, I've been here a long time. I was a journalist. I was, as you said, with the AmCham as a chairman and a board member. I used to go to Washington and lobby for fair-minded China policies and for China to get most favored nation and then to get into WTO. So as I've watched what's been going on in the last decade, when China hit its 10-year mark in the World Trade Organization, I decided I was going to take a look back and see where people thought China was going then and where it has actually gone. And we did enormous research, and China laid the facts out that China has not gone where everybody thought it was going to go, including the Chinese leadership in 2001. And I'll kind of lay out where it's gone. And people look at it as critical. And yeah, it is a critical examination, but it's about time somebody did one.
Oh, indeed, especially somebody with credibility in the business community. Because I think, as you point out, in China, one tends to find that business people don't like to speak their mind.
Well, you know, what I've also found is, you know, I advise a lot of companies. And what I found in the last 3-4 years is the CEOs and other business people, they will, in public, they're very smiley and supportive about what's going on in China. But behind closed doors and in their boardrooms, they're saying China's changed. It's not a welcoming place anymore. We need to be there because it's the growth market. But we got to look out for ourselves because the goodwill is gone. You know, it's not like we can prosper together and there's as China always likes to say, mutual benefit. They're feeling like that they're either have limited opportunities here until China can figure out what they are doing, or they're helping create companies that are going to become global competitors. So the attitude of the business community has changed profoundly. You may not see it in public because they don't like to speak publicly, but it certainly has, and that's bad for China.
So what are the problems that China's facing and the, you know, also the foreign businesses here that you identify in the book?
Well, here's how things evolved. I mean, in 2001, when China joined the WTO, China was headed towards more of a free enterprise economy. I mean, nobody ever expected it to be a complete free enterprise economy, but even Zhu Rongji, the premier at the time, was talking about natural monopolies for SOEs. Remember, this is the guy who laid off 50 million people from state-owned enterprise in a period of 10 years. And they were corporatizing the SOEs to bring them more accountable and make them more accountable companies. And the private sector was getting more and more room to run. And then as the new leaders came in, I think a couple things happened. One, they saw what was going on in Russia. And remember, Chinese system came from the Russians in the 1950s. They saw that the oligarchs, the Russian oligarchs, people from the KGB or other politically connected people, were getting the country's assets and privatizing them under individuals. And they saw some of that going on in the provinces here. And so, rightly so and smartly so, China, the government, and the party decided we need to bring this in. So they formed the SASAC, the State Assets Commission, to become the shareholder of the state ownership of the state-owned enterprise assets. And that's understandable. But then as things went on, in 2006, they came out with a directive on state enterprise, and they took approximately 24 major sectors, and they reserved them for state enterprise to completely control or have majority control of. And they were all the big heavy industry, telecom, technology, science, you name it. And the private sector started getting squeezed out. At the same time, they came up with a policy called Indigenous Innovation, which when the leadership came up with it, it was aimed at trying to get innovation going in China because they were so dependent on foreign technology and really with all the scientists and science establishment unable to really build it up. But as that filtered into the bureaucracy, it became a blueprint. The foreigners looked at it as a blueprint for technology theft because these big state companies, technology and industrial companies in these sectors were required to do joint ventures with state-owned enterprise, and they were required to hand over their technology as part of that.
Okay, so what does indigenous innovation mean?
Well, indigenous innovation came up in 2006. That's when the policy came out, but it was a 3 year in the making. And when Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao came into office, they looked around and they saw, China was basically pretty dependent on foreign technology. And the deal here was always you're supposed to trade market share for technology. But so many foreign companies were having their technology copied or ripped off that they became very careful about it. And meanwhile, so China felt cheated, like, wait, we gave you market share and we didn't get any technology. And the foreigners felt cheated because they came in and they were getting ripped off. So both people had a different viewpoint. So Wen Jiabao pulled together this group, and for 3 years they battled back and forth, and it was academics and scientists and government officials. And in the end, they pushed out the scientists and the government officials, the bureaucrats took over. So what you ended up with, instead of something that's really going to lead for innovation in China, it became a top-down, big-money program that doles out money to people based on their relationships, but also was aimed at forcing foreign companies that are doing business in China in leading industrial and technology sectors to do joint ventures with Chinese state-owned enterprise. And that state-owned enterprise were supposed to assimilate, absorb, co-innovate, reinnovate, and master the foreign technology. At the same time, they were also had this program of national champions. They're supposed to become national champions and go global and take on the very multinationals they're partnering with. So you can imagine this didn't go over well. It caused a huge hullabaloo in the foreign business community and kind of woke everybody up.
And then we had the financial crisis.
Yeah, and then the financial crisis happens. Well, simultaneously with the Indigenous Innovation in 2006, they also came out with a directive on state-owned enterprise, taking a couple dozen of the main core industrial and science and technology sectors and communications, et cetera, and designated they had to either be completely controlled or majority owned by state-owned enterprise, squeezing out a lot of private companies. Then the global financial crisis happens, 2008. China comes up with the equivalent of a $600 billion U.S. dollar stimulus. That money just floods into the SOEs, and the SOEs gain incredible power. And, they already had a lot of power, but this really threw them over the top. And then that has basically skewed the economy since. The report that came out in last year in 2011, I think it was April or so, the Unirule Institute independent institute with Mao Yushi, this 83-year-old economist. They came out
known as a rightist on the Chinese internet.
He is, yeah. Well, that's because he wrote an anti-Mao article that he paid for dearly. He had people attacking him all over. He's a very independent-minded guy, a story unto himself, really. But this report showed that if these big central state-owned enterprises, and I'm talking about the currently 117 big behemoths that are, you know, supposed to become the national champions, they're under the Central State Assets Commission, those are the ones that are really the problem. And he showed that if you take away their subsidies, they actually lose money despite their huge monopolies and their huge profits. But their free or cheap land, electricity, very cheap lending. I think they were getting loans at 1.6% interest. And in fact, you know, a lot of those are grants. They don't get paid back. And kind of on and on, he showed that they actually rob value from the economy. They had a negative return on equity of about 6.5. So that, you know, that just shows that, to be fair, let me be fair about these big state-owned enterprises. You walk out this door in China and you look up and there are new roads and highways and ports and airports and high-rises, and the infrastructure that has been built in this country is breathtaking and mind-boggling. That would never have happened without state-owned enterprise, without the state banks, the state planners, these big companies all working together to do it. Good on them. I mean, you've got to give China credit for that happening. That won't work going forward. That happened. It was good. But now, for the next stage of growth, it's going to have to be private enterprise. Because if they keep going on like this, they won't have the growth they need. Because 90% of jobs, 80% of innovation, patents, et cetera, come out of the private sector. The private sector here has moved ahead through loan sharks, et cetera, because they can't get money. They can't get access to credit from the banking system. You give them half a chance, and this country can move ahead pretty quickly.
So the kinds of things you're saying, I can, you know, see being receptive amongst the Western business audience, but one would imagine that true entrepreneurs in China who are not backed by the state would feel the same, right?
Well, not only that, but a lot of people in the government. I mean, it's funny, you know, I'm a former journalist, and this book has 250 footnotes. I didn't even know where the footnote button was on Word before I wrote this book. But we really nailed our sources on every fact in that book. Why? Because we wanted it to be solid, because we knew it would be critical and controversial. But also, most of our sources are Chinese. A lot of what we have is from a report done by the World Bank and the Development Research of the Center of the State Council, the 12th Five-Year Plan, all kinds of Chinese academics. And so a lot of these facts are from the government itself. There's a lot of people in the government that are very, very unhappy with the lack of reform, and they see real problems coming. And, you know, Wen Jiabao himself is kind of the standard bearer for warning that problems lie ahead and they need to move and they need to change.
And the problems are not just for foreign business. The problems are for China itself, for the Chinese economy.
Yes. I mean, what worked the last 30 years will not work the next 30 years, and China's at a turning point. And the World Bank report, you know, the Development Research Center State Council, the State Council, China's cabinet, its main think tank, did a joint report with the World Bank, 450 pages, came out early this year. It is chapter and verse of how China needs to reform, and it can't move ahead unless it does. Very, very clear. And one encapsulating thing in that was the middle income trap. What happens when a country gets to about $4,000 or $5,000 a year in income, and most of the time they've built their economy on cheap labor exports and on adopting technology from others, when they get to that point, things change. Labor costs go up, then it's harder to be the big exporter. And so what you have to do is you have to build a domestic economy, you've got to go on domestic consumption, and you have to go on your own technology and innovation. And that's where China's at. It's a very, very hard thing to do because the people who make money in the first stage do not want to take their fingers off the steering wheel. And so it's very hard to go the next step. It was in 1960, I think it was 113 countries had reached the middle income level. 1960, 100 and, 1960, 111 countries. By 1985, only 13 had broken through. Think about that. Why? Because you end up with vested interests that resist change. And I think that's why you end up with, you know, some of what we've seen in Latin America, the Middle East, and other places. That's what China faces now. And this is in the Chinese government's own report. They've got to break through. The good news is there are ways to do this. And two things. One that's very complicated. And this is Liu He, who is a top economic planner at the Development Research Center, who was, you know, instrumental in the World Bank report. He says that reforms in the past under Deng and Zhu and Jiang were, you know, crossing the river by feeling the stones, Deng Xiaoping's famous aphorism. But that you could do step by step. You try something, you know, try privatizing housing and building a real estate business, and then see what works, and then you expand it, and then you expand it, you expand it. And that's how China's done a lot of the reforms here. The next stage of reform is more like systems integration, and that's not going to be easy.
All right.
Yeah, if you... you know, one of the sources we used a lot was the Development Research Center, State Council, and various publications and studies they've done. And Liu He, one of the leading analysts and planners over there, I mean, he's probably the main economic advisor, really, for the leadership. He described this as one of the real difficulties of the next stage is it's no longer crossing the river by feeling the stones. It's no longer... try something, see if it works, expand it, see how that worked, you know, as they did with privatizing housing and all the other reforms they've done here. The next stage is very complicated. It's like systems integration. You have to have a lot of people working together. You have to have a lot of organizations working together, and you got a lot of make a lot of changes in different parts of the bureaucracy and the economy and the financial system at the same time.
And those changes will make a lot of people very uncomfortable, won't they?
They will. And you know, changes. You know, when everybody had nothing, everybody was for reform in China. Now they got a lot of vested interests that have something. They're not so much for reform. And I think a lot of these people that work in the government who have power of approval and they can make money doing that at every level, they're not going to want to give that up. So, yeah, there's a lot of people that don't want change. But there's a positive side to this, too. China has a great urbanization story. And we're talking right now, China's where the U.S. was in 1920. About 50% of the population is in the countryside, about 50% in the cities. The expectation is 13 to 15 million people, about the population of Tokyo, moving to the cities every year. If they can take those people and make them full citizens with residency permits, with access to healthcare, education, etc., and make them consumers, China, the way the State Council here puts it, if they can take 10 million people a year and turn them into no longer acting like migratory birds but being really part of full citizens again and make them consumers, China can drive global growth for a few decades.
But doesn't that very move also come up against another whole bunch of interest groups, the security services, everybody who has some interest or other in maintaining the hukou system? Isn't this one of the things that China has been talking about for decades already and not been able to really change?
Yes. I mean, you can't all of a sudden – they started this hukou, this housing registration system in the 50s to keep the farmers from flooding into the cities. So the way it is, you're registered where you're born. And to change that is very difficult. So what do we have now? If you look at the studies, about 25% of the people in China's major cities are not legally there. So they do not have access to any government services, education for their kids, health care for themselves, etc. So they're worse than undocumented workers in a country where they're illegal. But these are citizens of China who are, once they move to the cities, aren't really full citizens anymore. 25% of the people in the big cities. You've got about 160 million migrant workers who have come in, and these are the people that, you know, the country's been built on their backs. They have to be made citizens. How do you do that? Beijing, you know, with what do we have here? 18 million people or something now, and you
something
you
know, like that. 20 is the number I'm hearing more often these days.
And traffic's horrible. The air is horrible. I mean, you want 20 million more? No citizen of Beijing does. But again, this is a country with great planners, and they have very strong plans in all these satellite cities, and that's why they're building these bullet trains like zippers that go all around the country. And they, you know, all the satellite towns they want to build, and that they are already building, and the migrant workers there can build service industries. Let these people be entrepreneurs. I mean, there's a long ways that they can go if they unleash these people and give them half a shot. So it's going to take a mentality change, but it's also going to mean, I mean, I think the survival of the party depends on this, and that's what they themselves say. So who knows?
So your optimism is based on the fact that the party is self-interested, and you think that they are self-interested enough to see the writing on the wall and make the difficult changes that need to be made.
Well, you're either, you know, a place like China, you have a choice between repression and opportunity. And the first stage was built on opportunity. The last 10 years, there's been, you know, more and more repression. And then, eventually, you're going to run out of how much of that you can do. The answer is opportunity. And, I mean, how lucky are the leaders of China in that they got Chinese citizens as the people they govern? You don't have to, you know, tell anybody what to do, and you don't have to do a lot for them. All you got to do is give them half a chance, a wink and a nod, and say, you're free to do this, or even give an indication. They'll run away with it. All you got to do is give them a chance.
Let's go back to a company that isn't giving a lot of other companies a chance, UnionPay, which features in your book. So if you live in China, you probably are very familiar with UnionPay and perhaps use its products every day. They are the payment system of China. Every time you use a credit card or debit card in China or an ATM, you're using UnionPay. What's up with UnionPay, Jim?
Well, UnionPay is, I call it, the national champion trifecta. It's got, it has a monopoly. It has an adopted technology called PBOC 2.0 or something like that, where they, you know, they basically have taken the global technology for these transactions and added a couple whistles to it and made it their own, and they are going global. It is out of the central bank. If China wanted to do that, okay. They have the power to do it. The problem is, in the WTO agreement, China agreed that by 2006 that market would be open. It has not been open to this day. And now they have a monopoly on, you know, foreign credit cards coming in here. They have to use the UnionPay system, and they have to co-brand their cards. And now, internationally, you know, UnionPay is expanding very strongly overseas, and they're able to undercut in price. And so it's not fair competition. That I think is the core issue with China going international. These state-owned enterprise is they have all these hidden subsidies, whether it's just policy help or their own monopolies or all the subsidies we described earlier of low-interest loans. You know, billions and billions in credit from the State Development Bank. When they go overseas and they're fighting against established companies, they'll be able to undercut them on price and knock them out. Well, that's not fair competition. And so these markets that are open to China, if they let all the Chinese companies come in and they don't require some sort of reciprocity, it could be difficult. And I'm not an advocate at all of closing markets. In fact, I'm an advocate of the more Chinese investment overseas, the better, because Chinese companies going overseas are going to learn. They're going to learn they have to live by global rules, and that should work out. But except for these big state-owned enterprise, where they have all these advantages and they pretend they don't.
So, if there was one takeaway for a Western business person reading your book, looking at China, what would it be? Sorry to ask you to reduce a whole book to a soundbite, but
Well, you know, but it's not that hard. I mean, it really is. It's what went on in the past is not what's going to go on in the future. And so you better watch everything that goes on here, because what is very certain is there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. There's going to be a lot of change, and there's going to be a lot of pushback on that change. And so you can't think that the China you knew in the past is the China of the future, and you're going to have to adjust your strategies on doing so. And, you know, part of it is just, you know, we always have looked at it as foreign business people here. The more you invest in China, the happier China is going to be with you. Well, that's not the case anymore. Sometimes it's, wait, the foreigners are going to dominate this sector or that sector. You're going to have to change. You're going to have to turn your head around and try to figure out where China is going in the future. And it's going to be a constantly evolving thing to deal with.
I'd like to ask you one last question, which goes back to something we were talking about at the beginning. You know, as I said, I find a lot of foreign business people in China tend to not be very willing to speak their minds in public. You have now spoken your mind in public, and it is a book that is rather critical of the current system. You remain a business person active in China. Are you not worried about possible consequences of writing such a anti-China book, as certain people might put it?
Not at all, because it's not an anti-China book. What it does is it lays the facts out on the table. We identify our sources. I've been here 25 years. I've been very involved as a supporter of China on policy in Washington. I think I have the background and stature to take a look at what's really going on and put the facts out on the table. And as I said earlier, a lot of our sources are Chinese, so we're just putting out also what a lot of the people within the Chinese government are saying. And I have no fears of retribution, and if retribution came my way for speaking the truth with all the background I have here, so be it. I'm not going to change the way I am.
Well, that's great to hear. Thanks very much, Jim. So please go to Amazon.com. and buy his book, No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers. The last section of the show is recommendations, where we ask our guests to recommend a film or a book or a tweet or a blog post or something China-related. Jim, have you got anything for us?
Yes, I have to recommend a book, and it's been out a couple years, but it needs to be read. It's called The Party by Richard McGregor. Richard is no relation to me. He's a former FT bureau chief here, and he's now with the FT in Washington. It is a very readable, smart book on how the party really operates. And I think more business people need to read that, because they don't have an understanding of how this place really operates.
Thank you. That's a very good recommendation, which I would second. I'm going to recommend something that's connected to our discussion today, which was an article published on The Guardian by Isabel Hilton, looking at the reasons why Huawei has run into such troubles in the United States, and talking about how one of the problems facing Chinese companies is that something similar to what you just said, Jim, is that the Chinese government more or less forces companies to break rules, which completely unprepares them for the international stage where they're supposed to obey them. Anyway, a short and interesting little opinion piece by Isabel Hilton. On that note, thank you very, very much, Jim. It's been a pleasure to have you as a guest. And we will see our listeners here. You will hear us next week on the Seneca Podcast.
All right. Thank you.